We've made our way to the 19th chapter of Genesis, and I found that I actually have been enjoying this study more than I thought it would. Sometimes, I think in my mind, I think wearily about the Old Testament, but then as I get into it, there's such richness and such relevance for today, as New Testament believers. I get into it and I go, wow, I'm glad we're not missing this. In thinking about Genesis, as we've talked about before, it's like a soap opera. There's lots of drama, lots of scandal, and that's going to be, we're going to see that in the text today. If you wanted to make a movie of it, it would be a rather scandalous movie. But I love the fact that the text is true to what happened. The text records what happened with the patriarchs. It doesn't glaze over their faults. It's honest. And so we're going to read it and study it. I wanted to start kind of as an image to help us direct our study of Genesis 19. This place. How many of you have been to this place? Do you recognize this city? It's the city of Pompeii. And that's Vesuvius in the background there, down near Naples. Okay. And as you know, some of you probably studied, it's a very well-preserved ruin, right? Almost an intact city that was buried alive and they excavated it. It's very well-preserved. You can walk through about 150 acres. But you know some of the history behind Pompeii? I actually had to read to figure it all out, but found out that it was a very rich and materialistic city. Okay, it was a tourist haven for Romans. They would come to the sea, and wealthy Romans, obviously, and so wealthy city, well-to-do people, had a lot of possessions. It was a very pagan city, so it's full of pagan temples, right, to worship all these different various and sundry gods. And it was also a very perverse city. There are frescoes, paintings on the wall that they've discovered of all forms of perverse sexual acts. Prostitution was rampant in the city. So it was rich, it was pagan, and it was perverse. And in 62 AD, so 30-something years after the death of Christ, there was a pretty significant earthquake that shook the city, damaged many of the temples. And over the following years, since it was a wealthy city, they rebuilt. They put things in order. But it was almost like that earthquake was a precursor, a warning as to what was really to come. Because in 79 AD, they didn't have anybody that could detect the seismic action, what was going to happen. Vesuvius exploded radically. In fact, we have I've got an image that we pulled from the movie that imagines, it's kind of hard to see a little bit with the contrast, the mountain explodes and envelops the city in lava and ash. It was a fast and violent eruption. There was no time to get away. Once it had started, you're done. Many folks were buried alive right where they were standing. It was that quick. And that's why a lot of people were preserved, mummified by the ash instantly. The sky apparently blackened for 3 days, according to some of the accounts from people that survived in the area. The city was covered up to 25 feet by ash. That's why it was so well preserved. It was literally entombed instantly in ash. There was a testimony, discovered from a woman who was excavated. Her body had been entombed. It gives us an idea about the mentality of Pompeii. This woman, her feet were in a position where they were aimed at the city gates. So she was trying to get away in the last seconds there. But she was contorted, leaning back with her arms out, her face facing something on the ground. And they did some more excavation in that direction, and they found a bag of pearls that had been entombed and kept intact. She was trying to get a bag of pearls. Had she merely dropped them on her way out, or had someone else dropped them and she was going to grab them? We don't know, but she was willing to risk her life for a bag of pearls. Gives you an idea about the mentality of the people. She was about to die, but couldn't let those pearls go, whether she had dropped them or was trying to steal them from someone else who dropped them. I think, in my mind, I think, what a fool. You're about to die. Who cares about pearls? Run. But I do the same thing in different ways. How often do we as believers toy with the world, with sin, like it was nothing? We coddle our favorite sins. We get used to the world's way of doing things. We even lose our sensibility as to what is right and wrong. We can reach a point where we sear our own consciences, And we don't hear what the Holy Spirit's whispering to us anymore. And when our life starts to crumble around us, like happened very suddenly in Pompeii, we're unaware of it. We're desensitized. God knocks at the door of our heart, and He knocks some more. And if He doesn't get our attention, have you ever noticed that when God's trying to get your attention, if we don't listen, He knocks harder. Maybe brings something a little bit more painful. Knocks a little bit louder. Brings a little bit more painful experience. Trying to get our attention. Trying to shake us. To wake us. Perhaps we're able to see ourselves a little bit in the people of Pompeii. Maybe not quite the same level of depravity. Or maybe we tell ourselves, we could never arrive to that level of depravity. We could never arrive at that level of evil. Rather, we should say, if not for God's grace, I'd be just like them. And that's the truth. Each of us would be in the same place if it weren't for God's grace. Our text this morning is going to show us in a pretty intimate way about the depravity and the devastating effects of sin, what it does in the lives of believers and non-believers alike. So I put as the subject to this text, the great risk for believers to finish poorly. The great risk for believers to finish poorly. It's not something we're excited to necessarily talk about, but it's important. The text addresses it. Genesis 19 is long. It's a good, rich story. Let's read it together and then unpack it. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. And he said, "Now behold, my lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night. Wash your feet, then you may rise early and go on your way." They said, however, "No, we shall spend the night in the square." Yet he urged them strongly. So they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men you came to that came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them." But Lot went out to them to the doorway and shut the door behind him. And he said, "Please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with men. Please let me bring them out to you to do with them whatever you like. Only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Stand aside." Furthermore, they said, "This one came in as an alien and already is acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them." So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break the door. But the men reached out with their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. They struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. When the two men said to Lot, "Whom else have you here? A son-in-law, your sons and your daughters, and whomever you have in the city, bring them out of this place. For we are about to destroy this place because of their outcry, because their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it." Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, and said, "Up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city." But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. When morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away in the punishment of the city." But he hesitated. So the men seized his hands and the hand of his wife and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him, and they brought him out and put him outside the city. When they had brought them outside, one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains or you will be swept away." But Lot said to them, "Oh no, my lords. Now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness, which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, for the disaster will overtake me, and I will die. Now behold, this town is near enough to flee to, and it is small. Please let me escape there. Is it not small? That my life may be saved." He said to them, "Behold, I grant you this request also, not to overthrow the town of which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there." Therefore, the name of the town was called Zoar. The sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew these cities and all of the valley and all of the inhabitants in the cities and what grew on the ground. But his wife from behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Now Abraham rose early in the morning and went to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked down towards Sodom and Gomorrah, and towards all the land of the valley. And he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. Thus it came about, when God destroyed the cities of the valley, that God remembered Abraham, and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in which Lot lived. Lot went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains, and his two daughters with him. And he was afraid to stay in Zoar, and he stayed in a cave, he and his two daughters. Then the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is not a man on earth to come into us after the manner of the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine. Let us lie with him that we may preserve our family through our father." So they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father. And he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. On the following day, the firstborn said to the younger, "Behold, I lay last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also. Then you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father." So they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him. And he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Thus both the daughters of Lot were with child by their father. The firstborn bore a son, and he was called Moab. He is the father of the Moabites to this day. And as for the younger, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ami. He is the father of the sons of Ammon to this day. Ammonites. Wow. That's a rough story. We're going to see the devastating effects of sin in the life of Lot, kind of fleshed out. His living in the world and of the world. Obviously, we live in the world, but shouldn't be living of the world. We also see the breathtaking grace of God towards Lot many, many times over. So a little bit of context. We're studying the life of Abraham from Genesis 22 to from 12 to 22. And Gavino last week showed us in Genesis 18 and talked about three visitors from the Lord. You remember the end of chapter 18. They were perhaps two angels and maybe the pre-incarnate Christ or three angels. We're not exactly sure. But I want to read a verse from Genesis 18, 20 and 21, that speaks to our text. And the Lord said, "The outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to this outcry, which has come to me, and if not, I will know." This outcry is the outcry of the victims of the sin, people that are being abused. And these visitors, these angels, at the end of chapter 18, are heading down to Sodom and Gomorrah to verify this outcry. Obviously, God knows. But he's sending these angels down to verify that things are as bad as they appear. And then we see that Abraham intercedes for Sodom and for Lot. If you remember, he says, "God, if there are 50 righteous people, will you save the city?" God says, "Yes." "If there are 45, are there 40? And he gets all the way down to 10. Says, "Oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak only this once. Suppose 10 are found there." And he said, God said, "I will not destroy it on account of the 10. There aren't even 10 righteous in these two cities, giant cities. And they're going to be destroyed." But God responds to Abraham's prayers just the same. God saves Lot's family in another way. He takes Lot's family out and then destroys the cities. He did things a little differently than Abraham thought he might. So, in thinking about the context, Abraham is still where we left him, at the Oaks of Mamre. That's a place that's kind of up. Let me give you a little picture here. So here, the Oaks of Mamre. And we're not exactly sure where Sodom and Gomorrah were. Possibly in this valley of Shittim down here. But anyway, Abram is here in up on a high place. And he's looking down into the valley towards the Dead Sea, towards Sodom and Gomorrah. That's where we leave him in chapter 18. And we're going to find he goes back to that place to look at the destruction afterwards. So a little background on Lot that's really important before we jump in and look a little more in depth at the text. Peter speaks about Lot in 2 Peter, and this is really important. Let's read this. "And if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly lives thereafter, and if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, for by what he saw and heard that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation,
and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment. Peter here informs us that Lot was a genuine believer saved by grace. That's hard to believe looking at his life. His life doesn't reflect much of his faith. It seems that he didn't live the perversity of Sodom, but he made many compromises in his life. And we see those fleshed out. Peter tells us that he was tormented on the inside by the filth and lives of Sodom all around him, the evil around him, but he didn't do anything. He lived in the midst of it. He didn't necessarily do the filthy things they did, but live and let live. It seems he just laid low, went with the flow, didn't rock the boat for many, many years as he's living in Sodom. He's a believer, trusted in God by faith, but he was off the radar in terms of living out his faith in a practical way in his culture. Not there. So what we're going to see in Genesis 19 is the text is kind of divided by scenes. The first scene is in the evening, it describes, and then we'll see the dawn and the sun coming up. So we're going to kind of divide it by the way the text does. The first scene is in the evening, the first 14 verses, and it says, two angels came to Sodom in the evening. So these are two of the three men that had visited Abraham. They come down into the valley from up on the high place where Mamre was. And Lot recognizes them merely as men, as visitors, strangers coming into the city. He's sitting at the city gate. What happened to the third man? He probably went to Gomorrah to survey, because the survey was to both Sodom and Gomorrah. So two came here, and we're assuming probably that the third went to Gomorrah to do his survey there. So Lot is sitting at the gate. It probably means that he was a city official of some sort, because the important men would sit at the gate and would discuss and do business. That was kind of like the city hall, if you will. He wasn't just a resident, but was involved in the governing of the city. Lot had chosen Sodom as his city, and he had made it his home, and he was integrated into the society in some level. Moving forward, these two visitors are invited by Lot to come into his house to spend the night. So Lot is hospitable to them, just like Abraham was at the beginning of chapter 18. You know, hospitality is huge in the Middle Eastern culture, even to today. But the hospitality here, in this case, had a double importance. It was obviously the custom of the day, important to show hospitality to the guest. But it was also for protection. It was normal in this day and time to sleep in the square. It wasn't a big deal. You were safe to put your little cot together or whatever and sleep in the city square. But Lot knew about the wickedness of his town. He said, trust me, you don't want to sleep in the city square. Please, he urged them, please come and stay in my home. He knew what would happen. And maybe he thought, nobody will notice these visitors. We're going to quickly go home, close the door, and have a nice meal and go to bed. No. No. It says, the men of the city surrounded the house. All of the men of the city. From probably teenage boys to the old men. Young and old. Young sons who were following their fathers, who were following their grandfathers into sickness, depravity, generational sin. One generation following the next. We're not talking about a small group. All of the men of the city, from the young to the old, were coming to do something very perverse. It said that we may have relations with them. They were planning to rape these two visitors. There's no way to glaze over this. That was what they were coming to do. It wasn't merely an indecent proposal for homosexual sex. It was a brash declaration of the evil that they were intending to do. That's what they were planning to do. Beyond being perversely immoral, it was also horribly inhospitable. It was totally against their own culture to treat guests in such a horrible way. So, Lot, he slips out of the door, closes the door behind him. Brothers, don't act so wickedly. He appeals to their morality, which doesn't exist. And by saying, my brothers, he's appealing to their common bond as fellow citizens, has no effect whatsoever. For these men that have assembled, nothing else matters. They're fixated on doing this evil deed. That's all they care about. They want to move forward with that act. And Lot makes a proposal that seems to us completely foreign. He says, behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Yes, he's offering his daughters to be raped. That literally is what he's offering here. We can't glaze over that either. It's interesting. He said they're virgins. It's a good sign considering this culture that he's helped keep his daughters chaste. But now he's offering them to these ridiculous men, these wild men. Let's think about Lot's distorted worldly values. He's got a few things right, but a lot of stuff that's not right. He's got a cultural obligation to protect guests who are under his roof. I read some things that said that in that day and culture that you would, even to the threat of your life, would protect guests that were in your home. But he has an obligation before God to protect his family, his daughters. Lot compromises his values according to situational ethics. He does what's expedient at the moment instead of sticking to his values. And the sad thing is his daughters are probably listening to him make this presentation. Think of the damage that's being done. Obviously, they didn't go out and weren't raped. But think about he's offering them and they're hearing this. And the most ironic thing is that he offers his daughters to these men, and he's ultimately the one that will sleep with them. Obviously, he didn't choose to, but they trick him into it. Lot can't distinguish anymore between right and wrong. He's lived in the cesspool of the world and lived that life for so long, he can't reason anymore, right and wrong. Now, before we say, what a fool, that's my temptation, this happens to us on a different level. The world clouds our ability to reason and hear the voice of the Holy Spirit. And we begin to reason with the world's values and let things slip in. We make little compromises that become bigger. So how did the men respond? Stand aside. They didn't want to have anything to do with what he said. You can see how much they respect his newfound morality. Suddenly, Lot is a moral man and, oh, don't do this evil. It's likely that Lot had never before spoken of his faith. He's probably never before challenged the values of Sodom on any level. He never lived out his faith before his neighbors. No salt, no light from the family of Lot. And then suddenly he's trying to play judge. Oh, don't act wickedly, man. They're like, who are you? What right do you have to tell us what to do? They're like, who do you suddenly get all moral on us here? Let's make this a little bit personal, though. Let's think about this on a daily basis for us in our own lives. Do all of the people in our circles know who we really are in Christ? Do they know clearly that we're Christ followers? I'm not just saying that we're good people in front of them. Many pagans are good people. But do they see and hear from us salt and light of Jesus? Words and actions that speak of who we are in Christ. I'm not saying that we should be a Bible-thumping pest and beat them over that. No. But do they feel the love of Christ and do they hear the truth of Christ from us? Just on a day-to-day basis, do we interact with them? Is who we are in Christ a part of our interaction with colleagues, with our family, with our friends? So what happens? The men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. So instead of Lot saving his guests, the guests save Lot, right? The angels pull him inside because these men are about to crush him and ram the door down. So the angels pull him inside, block the door. And now it's clear to Lot that these guests aren't just men because they do a miraculous thing. They make all these men blind that are now groping around trying to find the door. It says they wearied themselves trying to find the door. Are you kidding? If I had just been struck blind, I'm probably going to fall on the ground and just be in shock. Until they were weary, they kept searching for the door. They were so bent on doing these perverse things that even in the midst of a miraculous thing, they're blind. They wearied themselves till they couldn't get back up anymore, trying to find the door to carry out their perverse acts. So verse 12, then the two men said to Lot, whom else have you got here? You need to tell all of your family and get out. For we are about to destroy this place because their outcry has become so great before the Lord. The cries of the victims has become a deafening roar in the ears of God. And he says, enough. I will not wait any longer. Judgment is due and it's coming now. Interestingly, though, Lot goes out and speaks to his sons-in-law, who were betrothed to Mary's daughters. Get up, get out of this place, the Lord's going to destroy the city. But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. Now maybe, this is the middle of the night, so he's waking sons-in-law up. He might have just seemed like an old crazy man. And they might have just taken him for crazy. But I think there's a deeper, more serious problem. It would appear that the sons-in-law hadn't ever heard Lot talk about God. Then suddenly he gets religious and talks about this God judging Sodom. There's no foundation for a discussion about God. He's never had any previous opportunities where he's shared about his faith, about this God that he serves or believes in. Had Lot lived out his faith in words and deeds with his family, with these sons-in-law, it would have been a lot easier, probably would have been more receptive to hear, the God that I serve is now bringing judgment. Would you please come with me to avoid death? And they might have listened. Let's make this personal as well. Think about this on a daily basis in our lives. Have we built a foundation with those in our circles that we might be able to speak with them about Jesus? If your colleague has a crisis, do they know about the hope you have in Christ? They could come to you. They might even ask you because they've heard you talk about him before. If your relative is dying, have you already opened the door to talk about Christ previously so it won't be such a big deal to say, look, you need Jesus before you step into eternity, desperately. If not, it's going to be much more difficult to speak in the moment of need. And so often, people are receptive to Christ when they're on their knees, in a moment of need, when they're broken, when they're hurting, like in these disasters in London. I'm not saying that God can't work if we haven't prepared the soil, we haven't laid a foundation, but it's much harder. Obviously, God can use us and use any situation. He's sovereign, he's all-powerful. But if we've laid a foundation by speaking previously and sharing and living our faith, it's much easier in those moments that are desperate. So we go from evening to morning dawning. In verse 15, when morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you'll be swept away. So dawn is kind of a biblical image of light making the darkness flee. So the night is dark. The dawn comes and God is going to obliterate the evil and make things right. It says, so the men seized his hand and the hand of his wife. Lot has to literally be dragged from the city. Can you imagine the scene? Think about all that's happened. He's almost killed by the Sodomite men at his doorstep. He's saved miraculously by these angels. He's warned over and over by these angels, two or three times. And he's still hesitating. I would be running. Let's go. Let's run. He didn't want to leave the city. Why did Lot behave like this? Maybe he thought God wasn't really going to destroy Sodom. He'll be merciful at the end. No, not this time. Maybe he thought, perhaps by delaying, I can provide a little more time for my family to repent, because he knew God wasn't going to destroy the city until he left. Maybe it was because he was about to lose everything on the earth that he owned and had worked for, and he was so attached to it that he really wasn't ready to let go. Think about everything that he'd worked for, his home, all of his possessions, his prominence in the city. It was all literally going to go up in flames in an instant. How do we do this, though, with sin in our lives? How do we hesitate in letting go of the sin in our lives? Sometimes we toy with sin like it was child's play, something light and fluffy. All of us have some pet sins. I don't know if what it is, sometimes different for each of us, gossip or lying or anger or pornography or pride. I don't know. We could make a big list. We think we're capable of managing sin, right? Come on, I can hide this. I can keep it small and manageable. I've got a little compartment for my sin over here. The truth is, sin ends up managing us and consuming our lives. We can't manage it. I came across a meaningful quote from Dr. Jim Dennison, who's in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He said, sin always takes us further than we wanted to go, keeps us longer than we wanted to stay, and costs us more than we wanted to pay. Every single time, this is true. The reason that Lot is rescued is not because he's a saved guy, not because he's a good guy. It's just because of God's grace. God responds to the righteous prayers of Abraham. We could say in a sense that Abraham has saved Lot twice. If you remember in chapter 14, Abraham took his 318 men and went and rescued Lot. When Lot got swept up, when Sodom was conquered by these other kings, Abraham goes and rescues him and brings him back. Saves the city of Sodom too. And here again, Abraham through his prayers, God's answering these prayers and protecting and saving Lot. God waits until Lot is gone before destroying Sodom. How does Lot respond? He says, "Oh no, my lords," speaking to these angels, speaking to the Lord. He recognizes, he says, "Your servant has found favor in your sight." He recognizes that he's been shown some crazy grace, but yet he's still resisting. Let's compare Abraham's prayer in chapter 18 to Lot's prayer in chapter 19. So in chapter 18, Abraham prayed to save these cities because of the righteous that he was imagining are there. "Lord, if there's 50 or 40 or even 10 righteous people, please save these cities from being destroyed." Lot prayed to save this little town of Zoar because it was more comfortable for him to go there instead of going up into the mountains. Lot didn't want to go up to the mountains. He was afraid of going that far. He said, "Oh Lord, let me just stop in this little town of Zoar. Please don't destroy it." Abraham had no personal interest in his prayer. Lot, on the other hand, was only motivated by personal interests. And yet, God still granted his request and allowed him to go to this little town of Zoar. And he didn't destroy the town. How patient God is with him and with all of us. We move to the next scene here. The sun had risen. So we've got the dawn and the sun has risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar. And it says, "He overthrew the cities, the valley, the inhabitants, everything that grew in the ground. Nothing survived God's destructive judgment. It was obliterated. It was a judgment that was just and deserved." And I've always thought this was curious about Lot's wife. It says, "His wife from behind looked back and she became a pillar of salt." We don't know exactly what happened, but I did some reading. And once Lot had exited the valley, the judgment could begin. Once he had exited that area, God could wipe it out. He was waiting for Lot to be out of that area. Perhaps Mrs. Lot was dilly-dallying and still missing her life in Sodom, kind of hanging back a bit behind where Lot was. She was literally a stone's throw away from safety with Lot in this little town of Zoar. But instead of listening and exiting the valley, she was just dawdling. She was thinking about her life in Sodom, looking longingly back. She was likely burned alive by molten sulfur. That was what came down, burning sulfur. I read what some scientists had thought about this. They said probably burning sodium sulfate, and probably this sodium sulfate burned her alive and then remained like a salt crust. And so she was burned alive in place and was encrusted with salt, and thus the pillar of salt. That was one explanation as to what might have happened. I've always thought it was curious. But we see the effects of sin in her life as well. And then the last scene, early in the morning. This is 24 hours after the dawn, so the next morning. This is where Abraham observes the destruction. He comes back to that place at the edge. He's up on high, the oaks of Mamre. He's looking down into the valley. And he sees smoke like a furnace coming up. God had destroyed these cities completely. So God had saved Lot from disaster on account of his covenant with Abraham. God had remained faithful to his promises despite Lot's sin. Lot didn't deserve to be rescued, but God was faithful to his promises that he'd made to Abraham. Listen to Abraham's prayers. And even all this, knowing Lot would become the father of Israel's enemies. The Moabites and the Ammonites were sworn enemies of the Israelites. God knew this was going to happen, and he still saved Lot. So what are the results of a life lived not only in the world? We have to live in the world, right? The world's all around us. But we don't have to live of the world. What are the results of a life lived of the world? We see those results in what happened to Lot afterwards. So We know that Lot went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains with his two daughters with him. So Lot brought his daughters out of Sodom, but he couldn't get Sodom out of his daughters. It was in their hearts. They had lived it. They had walked it. It was their lives. And he couldn't get out of their hearts. So what happens here? Basically, a quick summary. Lot's daughters get him drunk and they rape him to get pregnant. That's what happens. It's ugly. It's a level of perversity that's hard to even read about, much less consider. The author deliberately excludes their names because of what they did. Often when you see a name not mentioned, like Lot's wife is not mentioned, the daughters, their name is not mentioned. It's on purpose. They have to use alcohol to ply Lot because he wouldn't have agreed to something so sick. And here again, the irony is brought up that Lot ended up doing the evil he'd offered the men of Sodom. He offered his daughters to be with the men, and then he ends up being the one doing the evil with his daughters. So the result of these two incestuous relationships is that two nations opposed to God's people are born, the Moabites and the Ammonites. And for years, they were a plague for Israel. And this all the results of a life lived of the world from Lot and his daughters. So, thinking of Pompeii's destruction, it's very similar to that of Sodom and Gomorrah. And we don't know if Pompeii was destroyed, if it was a judgment of God, or if it just was a natural event. We're not really sure where Sodom and Gomorrah were, because very little remains of them. Some have said, oh, they found it, but we're not sure. They were obliterated by God, down to the crops and the plants, and so very little would remain. But both Pompeii and Sodom and Gomorrah were perversely sinful, consumed by their sin, and all were destroyed. Think about Lot. In record time, he went from city councilman to caveman. His life fell apart in a hurry. His living in the world and of the world didn't work so well. It cost him everything. His lifestyle was such that Sodom lived on inside of him, inside of his daughters, despite the city being destroyed. He couldn't get the Sodom out of their own hearts. The greatest tragedy, though, in all of this is Lot didn't finish well with God, with his faith. Lot was created to glorify God, point others to God, and bless others. Instead, he soiled God's name, pushed others away from God, and blessed himself. Now, Peter tells us, and I believe it, we'll see Lot in heaven, but how sad the legacy that he left here on earth. He left a sad legacy, not one that honored God. Every believer is at risk of finishing poorly like Lot. And we're prideful if we don't believe that. Lot's not alone in the Bible. There are other biblical examples. Solomon finished very poorly. If you remember, he married many pagan women and worshipped idols towards the end of his life. He finished poorly, just like Lot. He was a believer. Sadly, this happens sometimes to genuine believers. They finish poorly. Each of us is capable of doing the same or worse. It's only by God's grace if we don't finish poorly like Lot. God's grace is the only thing that keeps us walking with Him, faithful to Him. Each of us was created to glorify God, point others to God, and bless others. This is our sole purpose in being here on earth. Yet when we soil God's name or push others away from God and bless ourselves, I don't want to face Jesus after having finished poorly. So what can we draw away from the text to help avoid finishing like Lot, a believer who finished poorly? One thing we can see from the text: live out our faith humbly before everyone, in words and actions, living consistently around our colleagues, around our family, around our friends, the same way. Consistently, humbly living out in words and actions our faith. Another thing we can see from the text: that we should refuse to play with, to toy with sin, to tolerate sin, living in the world, but not of the world. And two more thoughts I would add. It would be helpful for us to daily confess that His grace alone keeps us from finishing poorly. Say, God, I realize the only thing between me and utter shipwreck of my faith is Your grace, is Your power alone. That is the only reason why I have not destroyed my walk. I have not utterly shipwrecked my faith. And daily, just to humbly embrace His grace, His love, the resources and the power that He offers all of us in the Spirit to walk with Him and to avoid the shipwreck of our faith. He gives us every resource we need in the Spirit if we'll walk with Him and trust Him. Everything we need to be faithful to Him is there already the moment we trust Christ.